political revolution are in the air these days, meaning at the ballot box. But today we talk with someone who remembers when folks were debating whether to build a nonviolent mass movement or create a violent revolutionary vanguard.
I had arrived in the middle of this juncture between two sides of this organization. One side was like really opposed to the idea of violence and felt that we were going to alienate people and that we wanted to engender their support. And the other side was we need this arm of the revolution.
That's Linda Coleman. We talk with her about her memoir, Radical Dissent, The Cultivation of an American Revolutionary. Then we asked Vermont political writer Greg Gouma about his take on Bernie Sanders' presidential bid. He's been writing about the senator since the late 1980s. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Terrorist or freedom fighter? That's the question my guest Linda Coleman contemplates in her memoir of getting involved with a leftist guerrilla group in the 1970s. Radical Dissent is a moving document about a time that America has nearly forgotten, when struggles over civil rights at home and interventionist wars abroad gave birth to a mass student movement. In 1970, that movement was riven by two opposed approaches to political change. One chose mass organizing, the other chose to go underground to carry out bombings and bank robberies to build what it saw as a vanguard to a coming revolution. Neither faction saw its dreams realized, but both put their mark on history and what came after them. Linda Coleman was a naive young woman from a privileged background when she became involved with a guerrilla cell in Portland, Maine. She never carried out any violent acts herself, but she did use her time and her inherited money to support the group's activities. Until that is, she realized violence was not the way she wanted to make change. Full disclosure. I know Linda Coleman personally as an ordained monk in the Zendo, or Zen community, where I go to meditate. As a Zen practitioner, she's no less interested in social justice now than she was in her youth. But instead of violence, of course, she promotes nonviolent action. For 10 years, Coleman has been working with incarcerated women, leading weekly memoir writing workshops, and publishing 3 collections of writings from those workshops. Her book, Radical Dissent, is published by Pushcart Press. Linda Coleman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for having me.
Now, this memoir, Radical Dissent, it's really a searing memoir that grapples with some very complex moral issues. In fact, I think you could say that morality, or the one's moral stance, is really at the heart of the book.
I would say that this is really a quest for how to find right action in the face of great evil and wrongdoing. But for me, at that juncture, I was so young and so naive that I was very prone to give my power away to others in a way, and to really be swayed by a lot of the great compelling dogma of that era and rhetoric that spoke to what could become the right way and led me in some ways. So, but it's a very complicated. I had to go in very deeply in this memoir. I had to tell my truth, and in that way, I had to go very slowly. It took me a long time to write this in order to uncover how much I was motivated by interpersonal relationships with my parents, psychology, my own insecurities, as well as my real desire to see the world be a fairer and more just place, and being very driven by that as well. So these people were very compelling to me and very different from people that I'd grown up with, so.
The people that you're referring to are the people in the revolutionary group that you became part of. Give us the context. I mean, how old were you? When did this happen? When did this all start? How did it start?
I could go back a little bit earlier, even before it started, that I grew up in a very privileged background in a community that was, my little segment of the five towns of Long Island was all WASP families, a small group of remaining 150 families, and then surrounded by a larger Jewish community, and then Inwood, which was a very poor African-American community at that time. And I had inroads into both of those communities through my mother, who was an activist in her own right. And so I got to see how very isolated we were. We went to private schools, we had a private beach club, private country club, everything was very segregated, and no Jews, no blacks allowed in any of these institutions. So that was always felt very odd to me from a very early age. I was very uncomfortable with that. I had a nanny who was from Ireland, and I loved her dearly, and she was from a very poor background. And so I think I started to develop some consciousness around very early on, and then I was allowed through circumstance to go to spend a year in Umbaban, Africa, and when I was 17, and that also was very revelatory to me. I got to work with people who totally embraced me and really had nothing but a pencil stub around. The students I worked with had like a pencil stub around their necks and came to class barefoot. So it was a very, again, very different. And when I came back, I went to Hampshire College, where simultaneously, I went to college there, was introduced to socialism and Marxist ideas, and also inherited money from my parents in a trust fund. And that was really disturbing to me. I felt like that money didn't belong to me. It had come off the backs of the working class, and that I had ancestors who were robber barons. And that money was a very loaded transit for me to inherit that, and then to figure out how I was going to relate to it. I dropped out of college, and I went to Portland, Maine, and I was looking for political work of some kind, leftist, to get involved in. And I walked into this bookstore, the Red Star North Bookstore, which had been started by a small group of people. The main ringleader was a man who'd been a political activist in Maine and in the prison movement for some time. And he had been politicized as having been in the army during the Vietnam War, and had gone over as a real patriot, found out what we were doing there, came back very disillusioned. Long story short, that situation blew up very quickly. I was only there for about 3 or 4 months when our bookstore had started being threatened by people who said they were going to attack us, and then ultimately did attack us.
And actually, you believe it was the police behind it, and one of the members of your group got raped.
Yes. One of the things that compelled me to get involved with the group in the bookstore was that when I arrived there, there was this advertisement in the window for a demonstration that was going to protest a Portland police death squad that had designs on eliminating certain members of the radical community by murdering them and putting them under a beltway that was going around. So this was actually fact, and the four policemen who were involved were subsequently, you know, taken off the force.
So this was a pretty charged time. The Vietnam War was going on. It was very intense right there in Portland, Maine. Now, your grandmother also lived in Portland. One of the things that's very affecting about your book is how you struggle with your class privilege, but also your love for your family. So, you know, talk about your grandmother, there you were living in Portland, involved in revolutionary politics. Could you talk with her about it?
So this was 1971-72 in that era. It wasn't, sorry, 73-74 is that period. And my grandmother lived in the outskirts of Portland in the well-to-do community, also very segregated. And she was a very dear, loving, kind woman who had grown up. She was already in her late 80s at that point, and she was very loyal to her family and loved her grandchildren. And she was a safe haven for me in many ways. She took me in at many different times during this period. But she was also quite overbearing. She was a real worrier, so she would call me like 20 times a day, and she wanted to bring me crab meat and leave little packages by the door. And so all these signs of privilege that were keeping me sort of held, and I really wanted to be in some ways separated and divorced from all of it. But the heart tug was there, and also trying to figure out how to manage both the politics of that she had no way of understanding really at that age, or I couldn't assume that she would, and not serve crab meat because crab meat, the lowest paid workers in the state were crab meat pickers, and it was a terrible job. So, but she couldn't understand that, nor could she understand the blueberry pickers in her that she got in her from her private cook who made us blueberry muffins, came from the other lowest paid workers in the state. So, that kind of contradiction.
What you're really showing here is how almost every movement you made had in the back of your mind, where's my class privilege in this? Where is my moral stance? Can I do this? Can I not do this? How did that express itself when you became part of this group in the bookstore?
I had to separate from my parents during this period. I had a few letters exchanged with them, but really I had to turn myself over. I felt like I really had to turn myself over because of this circumstance that unfolded with the bookstore and then the attack on the bookstore. And the attack, we got a note that was said it was from the Ku Klux Klan, and they were going to come after all of us. And at that point, the people who showed up to protect me were these three men in the group and a couple of other women who were on the periphery. And I couldn't imagine my family. Couldn't imagine my family showing up for me in that way. You know, I couldn't imagine them, first of all, being in a circumstance where they'd been attacked and you needed to defend or protect. But it was very impressive to me that there was no hesitation on their part that they would take me in as a sister, that they became my brothers in a way that I didn't feel my family at that point could show up for me.
So you're in this group. Most of the folks in this group, were you the only one who came from a wealthy background? And how did you feel your position was in the group because of that? Or how did you feel it was? Because I think there's a lot in your memoir where you're exploring your terrible fear of rejection, which seems, you know, very fundamental to you at the time, probably pretty natural, and also exploring this new family. So there's some real contradictory currents going on.
So I was really hiding my class background from them in the beginning. And they were all from very, very, very solid working class background, where their parents had been, you know, working in the mills as French Canadian or working, you know, three jobs in other families, and very much solid working class and poor backgrounds. But all three of the men had been ex-military, so they'd all been politicized in the war. And so there was a lot going on for them that I felt nobody in my life had ever had to grapple with this kind of difficulty. And so I was really hiding my class background from them as best I could for quite a while. I was, you know, sure that they were going to find me out. And that was hugely anxiety provoking for me. But I don't think I had much wool pulled over their eyes. I just thought I did, you know. So, but they, again, nobody, you know, rejected me. Nobody, you know, I didn't feel like people were wooing me either. So I didn't feel like there was any kind of ulterior motive going on in terms of their, you know, accepting me into the groups that we started to form. We did a study group, and we did some work on a newspaper, and we did, then after the bookstore got attacked, then we did other kinds of work as well. That at that point, half the group went underground, and I had arrived in the middle of this juncture between two sides of this organization. One side was like really opposed to the idea of violence and felt that, you know, we were going to alienate people and that we wanted to engendered their support through violent tactics. And the other side was, we need this arm of the revolution, and we need to develop this arm of the revolution. And that was the group that really became so powerful in their rhetoric to me, because we had been attacked, and because they were saying that, okay, now you need to carry a gun. You have to, because they were going to rape all the women in the organization, and who knew, and the police were, all of our suspicion and some, you know, supporting documents were behind them as well. And I also didn't realize that the woman that was raped was married to a man who was on the 10 most wanted list. So they had been They had been fugitives for the last 6 years, and they had two young children who I then came to know. And so it got more and more complicated in terms of my friendship affiliation with them and what you do to support your friends and how you show up for your friends and then as also your comrades, which in some ways was sort of different, you know, same, same, but different.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Linda Coleman. She is a Zen monk now, but back in the 1970s, she was a revolutionary, and she's written a memoir called Radical Descent, The Cultivation of an American Revolutionary. So your part of the group went underground, and your father, as you'd mentioned before, had given you some money. He gave you $150,000 when you were 20 years old. What were your feelings when you got that money?
I was very troubled by it. I knew at that point, I said in the first one of the first chapters of the book, I talk about the Nestle's Corporation, and some of this money was invested in Nestle's, and Nestle's Corporation having run this campaign in Africa of selling powdered milk and infant formula and having women mix the powder up with water, which gave the babies diarrhea, and there was a lot of death as a result of that, which sort of encapsulized the very evil potential of corporate interests. So not that all corporations go down that route, which I now feel, but at that point I was like, all corporations are bad, capitalism is evil in its very heart, you have a conflict of interest, you have a need for profit, and that triggers people's greed, and therefore you can't uphold the democracy, the democratic values that we have that are wonderful, but, you know, because you have capitalism as an economic system, it's in conflict with those values. So when my father gave me that money, you know, he was a very 1950s man. He was like, he was, you know, a commuter. He worked very hard. He was a corporate lawyer. But what I saw as a child was that he came home late. He left early. On the weekends, he was never around. I had very little personal interaction with him in a way, and yet I really loved him. He was sort of somebody I felt safe with. My mother, less so. She was more critical of her daughter. She was a little more insecure in her own way, and so that relationship was much less safe. But my father, I had a real tenderness for, and so the money, I wanted to be grateful, but I wasn't, and I was already on this road to try to rectify some of the wrongdoing of my inheritance, I'd say.
$150,000 was a whole lot of money back in those days, and when you went underground, the group came to you pretty much for the first time and said, you know, we'd like you to help us with money. What did they ask you for, and what were your feelings about that?
The first time I was asked for money was when two of the people were arrested. This man, Roland, who was one of the main characters, and the man that I eventually get involved with, the ringleader of our group at the Red Star North bookstore. And then Harland also was arrested. The two of them were arrested, and I was asked to bail Roland out of jail, and then ultimately Harland as well. And I felt at that time somewhat conflicted, but not really. I felt like this was they were the leaders of this group, and therefore the money was going to support leaders of this new paradigm that we were trying to propagate in this country, and so therefore I should support them by giving the money.
The question did come up that from other people that they might be exploiting you because of the money. Did any of those doubts begin to come into your mind? And looking at the time, and even now, looking back on it, do you think that they were really, you know, basically that was what you could give to the group and that's what they asked for? Or do you think that you had a special position because of the money and that that engendered all kinds of complications?
Both. This group was very small, and from my perspective now, when I look back on it, it was extremely isolated. In fact, there wasn't a revolution going on really at that time. We were well beyond the days in some ways by then of that surge actually gaining real momentum. So, and again, I was so naive in some ways that I didn't even have that historical perspective at that point. So I never felt really that they were abusing me for my money. I felt like they were willing to have me say no and still be a part of that group. And that way I felt they were honorable and good people in terms of understanding friendship and loyalties. That, again, I don't know to this day how naive that is. I mean, there were a couple of fringe members that I get involved with later on, and that's towards the end of the book where I end up leaving the group, which I can say that I had many more suspicions about. Not that they were, well, one of them was a really dark person, but the other guy was not such a dark person. He was just a troubled soul who'd been through a lot in his life. So I can't say that they were out to just get my money.
So you went on the run with them. You went out to Colorado with Harlan and his wife, Jo, and their two kids. You set up camp somewhere in Colorado. When did you begin to have questions as to whether you wanted to be in this situation or not?
Well, at that juncture, we weren't underground. This was when Harlan had been arrested for the SDS alleged activity that he'd been on the run for 6 years.
And SDS was the
Students for Democratic Society. So back in the 60s, he had been involved with them and had been alleged to have been involved in a bombing of transmission towers, had subsequently gone on the run for 6 years when I met him. So he was arrested shortly after I met him. And then he had been extradited to Colorado, where the charges were originally came from. So I traveled back and forth helping his wife, who was an epileptic and had these two children and couldn't fly, and so we had to drive. So we made several trips back and forth across country at that time to both help Roland get out of jail and also to help get the defense fund going for Harlan in Colorado. And after a while, I felt like I just wasn't doing that much there. I felt like a glorified babysitter in a way. I loved her children, and I was very fond of the mother, Jo, as well. But I just didn't feel like my political work was really manifesting in the way that I wanted to.
Now, I was active in the movement at that time as well. When we say SDS, you know, there were really two main factions, I guess, of the student youth movement, the revolutionary movement. One was more the ones who thought they were going to create a vanguard, do violent acts that were going to spark the excitement of the American people to come and join the revolutionary youth movement. I think that was called originally Revolutionary Youth Movement One, and they became the Weathermen. The other was the Revolutionary Youth Movement Two, which was the one that I became involved in, who felt that, you know, we had to build a mass movement, and we went and worked in factories at the time to get to know, quote, the people, unquote. Yeah. And you seemed like you were very isolated in this one group. Did any of the questions at that time come to your mind? Were you aware of the other faction and all the work in organizing and in communities, working class communities around tenants' rights, around workers' rights? Were you aware of any of that happening? Was that a choice for you?
It was a choice because the other half of the group that were in the study groups had, and actually the man that I got involved with, was very involved in community work up until that point. And he had been harassed so many times in every step of the way in his political work, above ground political work, by the police. And every one of those groups had been sabotaged in some way, at least he felt. And we had a real falling out with the other leader of the above ground aspect of this organization, who had become an organizer of all those in all those ways that you describe as well. So the two of them really had a ideological split at that juncture when the police attacked the organization. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was sort of held up to this bar of which side are you on? Are you on the which side? Are you going to really go to the mat with us? Because this is really the good side to be on, is this side. We're the ones who are really willing to die for the revolution. These other guys are sort of like armchair revolutionaries, is the way that it was spelled out to me, and that I felt I really needed to, like, make this very, very deep choice of like, okay, am I going to be with the armchair revolutionaries and just talk about this, or am I going to put my life on the line with these guys? And I don't know. It was, when I look back on it now, it seems very easy to see the delusion there, but I couldn't see it then.
Do you think that your emotional background, your struggles over acceptance and your shame as to your class background had something to do with the choice that you made?
Yes, I definitely do. I think there was, I had a lot of personal issues that I had to work through. I think that's why this memoir took me so long to write. It took me over 10 years to really do this. And in the meantime, I had to sit with all kinds. I had to take it very slowly in terms of the writing of it so that I could really stay true to the voice of that 21-year-old, 22-year-old, 23-year-old. And then going on further on, because the trial came back to me later on when they got arrested 10 years later. So it went. It was a long period of my life that I had to really investigate deeply.
Yeah, so the trial, you did leave the group just at the point where they were about to embark on, you know, what could have been violent actions, bombings, in fact, you know, to get money or to, you know, bombings of organizations, of companies, and of, you know, military kind of places that would, you know, express their political point of view. And you came to a kind of moment of truth in a farmhouse in 1974. What was going on there?
Well, at that juncture, I'd been asked to drive a cache of dynamite up to this safe house where Roland and a few of the others were staying at that juncture. And the two people that I drove with were men that one of them I'd known quite a while, another one I just recently met, and I didn't feel all that confident in him. In fact, I thought he was kind of slippery and very young and insecure. So,
And more than slippery, I mean, he engaged in some pretty crazy behavior on the way up.
Yeah, I was going to get there. So we're on the way up, and I was supposed to be driving, but he was at the wheel when I first got in the car, and he's like, I'll take the first shift, and then he lit a joint, and then he popped a beer, and then he had some pills, and he was passing those around. Did I want any? And no, I did not, but I was feeling like, this is insane. What is going on with these people, and what are their real motivations here? They're both ex-cons. They both seem to be sort of having trouble in their transition back into the open world. So I didn't trust them, and I felt like I was putting my life on the line and a lot of other people's lives on the line. I also felt like I couldn't align myself with bombing. I had already been involved in driving a car for a bank robbery, and that no one got hurt at that juncture, but they could have. And I felt, I was more and more feeling like I don't want to align myself with violence. Mm-hmm. That was really, and so at that meeting at the farmhouse that weekend that I stayed there, I wrote them a letter, which I read to them about how I wanted to withdraw.
And how did they respond?
As I remember, nobody, you know, they let me go. It was like I had real moments of fear and doubt because some of these characters had, you know, pledged that they would, you know, kill the people who might leave the group because it would be a breach of their security. And I didn't really ever think that, but there were, you know, some heart pounding moments just to be brave enough to say, I'm leaving, I'm not going to do this, I don't support this, was really hard for me, as I remember at the time. So,
Linda Coleman. We're talking about her memoir of her life in a left-wing guerrilla cell in the 1970s, Radical Descent, DESCENT. We'll talk more after the break.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. No, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. Well, I wake up in the morning, fold my hands and pray for rain. I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. It's a shame the way she makes me scrub the floor. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Linda Coleman about her memoir of her life as a left-wing radical in the 1970s, Radical Dissent, The Cultivation of an American Revolutionary. It's an intimate account of her choice to join an underground guerrilla cell. Just before the break, Coleman was talking about her decision to leave the group. Now, let's find out what happened after that.
So then you tried to forget them in a way. You got involved in other things. You got married. You got married to your first husband. And through the years after that, you heard tell of bombings going on, and you wondered if it was this group. Was it?
Well, I did actually. I moved to New York City, where I went to nursing school, and I worked in a city hospital, and I was involved in union organizing. So it wasn't like I completely left the leftist realm. I was still very much sort of stewing all of that stuff. Where do I want to get involved? How do I want to be in the world? During that time, in fact, I was seeing their 10 Most Wanted posters, because they had gone on to do several bombings around in and around New England as the New Liberation Front and Jonathan Jackson unit. And I was really averse to getting anywhere near them. I tried not to follow what was going on. I think I had sort of like post-traumatic stress from that whole such intensity just, you know, unfolding so quickly in my life there. And the FBI came to my house, came to my apartment several times, came to my parents, came to my friends. They were constantly trying to get me to talk to them, which I never did. But then I married my first husband, and I became pregnant, and I was called to testify at the grand jury, and that was fraught.
It was fraught.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, it was a really difficult the passage for me to decide which side, you know, there was another, which side are you on? Are you going to go and tell, I mean, being a quote unquote rat is like the worst of all possible, you know, skins to wear. And so I went through a lot of real turmoil over this whole decision of whether or not to testify. And at the time I would have been incarcerated for the duration of my pregnancy if I hadn't, and then open to being indicted on other crimes after I got out. I'd just been married. I was newly married. My husband was freaking out, totally opposed to my not testifying, to my refusing to testify. So I had no support from him. I had a lot of dialogue with my friend, my close family, parts of my family and friends that no one said that there was one right way to do this. So my father was also dying of cancer at that point. I'd come back into my family. And so there was no right way, I felt. When I started feeling my son move in my belly, that was it. I just decided that I would testify. Because I really had disavowed myself of their tactic and separated from the group 10 years before. And for right or wrong, I felt like I'd made a different choice, and they had not. And they'd continued on that path very stridently. So,
and there was a moment there that you describe in your book, Linda Coleman, you describe in your memoir, Radical Dissent, and that's spelled D-E-S-C-E-N-T, Radical Dissent, where you were cross-examined by the leader of the group because he was acting as his own lawyer. Talk about the feelings that you had when you confronted him directly there.
I was at that point, that was during a federal sedition trial that he cross-examined me, and that was a horrible, horrible time. I was 8 months pregnant with my second child at that point. So I had to testify twice. I was testified once when I was pregnant, and then right afterwards I gave birth. Then I came back to give another second testimony. And I still felt really tormented by the whole situation, and I didn't feel any disaffection for him in a certain way. You know, I've been very close to him. I'd been intimate with him. I had no reason to hate him or want to do wrong to him. I felt really badly for being in the position that I was in. I didn't think that it was right, but I didn't think it was wrong. It was like I was in kind of a no man's land, and I don't know. Life takes its own course sometimes, and that's the course it ended up being for me. So I can't really say that it was really, really horrible to be up there and to have him be there. And I felt a certain connection to him. I'd been, you know, I still feel that it was not, there was neither wrong nor right. In some way, I understand the mudslinging that I would get from people about testifying. I understand that. I also see that it wasn't the wrong thing to do either. I can see both.
Right. And you had a responsibility to your children as well. One thing I don't understand, though, is why did you not come up for charges? I mean, you had been an accessory.
I think it was because I left at the juncture that I did. That's one reason, I think. I don't know. I think it had also to do with my class background. I think my father, who had been connected by family friendships to the judge that was in Portland, Maine at the time, I don't know. I have no way of knowing, or he never told me, and I never asked him outright, did you ever cut a deal with Judge whatever his name was? I don't remember. But I feel like that's probably the way that it worked, and that's probably the way that it often works in this system, unfortunately. I was, a white girl from an upper-class family, and I'm sure that I would have been indicted had I participated in that bombing. I'm sure I would have. But the fact that I got out when I did, I don't know. Maybe that was it, and maybe somebody pulled strings that I don't feel... it's a corrupt system in that way. So, and in some ways, I wished for a long time that I just had gone to jail, because it would have been like a way to not carry the karma of that privilege with me. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I should have. It's still there. I still have some of that feeling of like, what was that the wrong thing to do? But more and more, because of the path that I've been on, do not support violence as a way of dealing with issues in the world.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that path. I mean, you became involved as a Zen Buddhist. Is there a connection between the events that you cover in this memoir, Radical Descent, and your later decision to become involved with Zen Buddhism?
You know, my involvement with Zen happened. It's sort of hard to say. It wasn't that I was out looking for it. It was more that I arrived in the Zendo one day by, you know, this infinite trail of events that brought me there. And I arrived, and that was home for me as soon as I got there. And the more longer I stayed, the deeper my investigation of what it really means to be free, and how do you live a life of non-harming, and why do people fight, and why is there, when people get attached to positions on either side, that the war can begin all over again, that there isn't, I saw the danger of rhetoric and polemic and taking sides in these very dogmatic ways. And so I really had to sit with, in Zen, you sit with not knowing. You sit in the space of not knowing the answer, and then arriving, bearing witness to what comes up in the moment, and out of that coming up with compassionate action. Those are like the three tenets of social action in Zen communities that I'm involved in. And that feels, from my work, I just spent 10 years working with women writing memoir in the Suffolk County Correctional Facility, and, you know, with over like 1,000 women there over that period. And that became such a powerful experience for me, and really seeing that you can open your heart to anybody, and they can feel that, and that can transform. That has a huge power of transformational power in terms of healing and communion and community building and reconciliation and all kinds of. I didn't really understand the power of that until I actually practiced it in that circumstance. Healing for me as well as for them. Healing. We worked with women who, you know, had been through the worst of abuse and poverty and drug addiction and violence and all kinds of things, and had done horrible things themselves. And to be heard and to be able to be in the presence of others who were just being with them in that totally attentive way, it was so powerfully healing. It was a really profound experience for me during those years. And I think it really, if anything, solidified my my path in Zen, as well as my teachers and my Sangha community, the people I practice with. It was really working in that capacity with those women in the jail. They really, really showed me the path to an open heart and how powerful that is. So,
if one must remain in the place of not knowing, how does one take right action against injustice?
Well, I think you have to really sit with the idea that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, for one thing. You can't assume that one way is the right way in that way that we understand it, but maybe you have an opinion, and your opinion can be very strong. And I also think if you stay in the intention, you're clear in your intention that you don't want to harm anyone or any being or anything, that you have to navigate situation by situation, and nothing is clear. There's no one way to do this. It's way too complicated for us to decide that, oh, this is the right way here and that's the wrong way. It may be that some aspects of this way are going to be really beneficial to at least some part of the human race or the animal race or the environmental, you know, our environmental circumstances, but it might be harmful to another aspect. It's very hard to know. So you do the best you can, and I think you do the best you can by not abandoning anyone and by staying in that space of not knowing the answer, at least at the outset, before you take action.
So in other words, not knowing is not a path to inaction. It's just when one takes action, one has to be willing to stay in a place of ambiguity, of not knowing.
Absolutely, that you're not ever really entirely sure, but it will arise. What action comes from out of that space of really bearing witness to what's in front of you, an action will arise grounded in compassion. I guess you could say, you know, Buddhism is a very ethical practice in a lot of ways. We're guided by precepts that are not commandments, but that are guidelines to how to be a warrior for peace, you could say, or how to discover the power of an open heart that really makes no conditions in terms of how it loves and the power of that. And I saw that, you know, again, in the jail with correctional officers that I worked with, people who at first were so hard-edged and so closed down and so inaccessible, and that if you just meet somebody eye to eye with love, it's amazing how they soften. So if you're really, I mean, you can't fake it. You've got to feel this kind of like, okay, I'm here to just really meet you where you are. Where are you? And let me talk to you. That's a very, very powerful, I think we so underestimate the power of that. And we are so imprisoned by our little protective ideas of how to be a self in the world. And that we have to protect that and be a certain way that defends it. So it takes practice. It takes a lot of practice. And practice meaning going deeper and deeper into what does that self really consist of? And who is it? And where? What is it? And then so as it starts to come apart a little bit, you realize that you're actually, first of all, you're not a permanent being. You're constantly changing and you're constantly interacting, and that everything you interact with supports your life. And so how can you harm it? Why would you want to harm it? You'd be like harming yourself. I'm not that I never had the inclination to harm myself, but that's when myself was very, very imprisoned in its own ideas of who it was. So,
and yet you were also driven by profound feelings of love and compassion even back then. So as you look back, having completed this memoir and the years that it took and the struggles that you have gone through, do you see some continuity there between your very, very young and naive self and who you are today?
Definitely. I think this real struggle for me has been parsing out I was sort of the nurse in the family. My mother was hospitalized several times for back injuries and back operations. And so I was her designated nurse. Now, I may have always been inclined in that way. I've been a nurse ever since. But I think there was a large part of my psychology that needed to, quote, do good in order to stay in the family fold, to get the little morsels of attention I could get from my parents. So in that way, that's not the open heart. That's the heart that is being driven by needing to just be good so that she gets the love of everybody around her. That's a very different energy from the open heart that's unconditional. And that I've started as I've gotten deeper in my practice. I really can understand the difference between those. And so I really try to nurture the practice that I feel so dedicated to nurturing that practice in myself of really, what does it take to keep feeding that real unconditional loving part? And that means going into situations where it's challenged, staying in uncomfortable moments, you know, really, like I think Pema Chodron says, you know, so much of the war in the world is caused by moments of just being uncomfortable and wanting to seek a way out of that discomfort instead of just staying with it and owning that in yourself and not running from it by creating an opinion and a dogma and a slap back or a position that's going to be right, you know. So anyway, I feel like that's probably the most important work for me to do in this lifetime.
Well, Linda Coleman, it's just been so interesting, such a joy to talk with you about your life and about this particular time in your life that you cover in your memoir, Radical Descent, and to talk with you about where you've come now in your life as well.
I'm so grateful for this opportunity, Francesca, and I'm very impressed with the work that you do with all writers.
Linda Coleman is a nurse practitioner and a Zen monk on Long Island's East End. Radical Descent is out from Pushkar Press. Most Americans have just been getting to know Bernie Sanders in the last few months as his presidential bid has gathered a full head of steam. But Greg Gumma has known him since the 1980s. A journalist, novelist, and political writer, Gumma has worked with and written extensively about Bernie Sanders. His 1989 book, The People's Republic, Vermont and the Sanders Revolution, was the first comprehensive analysis of Sanders' years as mayor of Vermont's capital city, Burlington. In 1988, Gumma wrote about Sanders' failed gubernatorial campaign against Madeline Cunin. In 2013, he wrote perhaps one of the first articles in the press about Sanders' presidential hopes, One Man Show, What Happens If Bernie Sanders Runs for the Presidency. We caught up with Greg Gumma on Skype to ask him for his thoughts on Sanders' presidential run, now almost a year into it, and more than 2 years after first writing about it.
That article was written because he was contemplating running. I don't think at that point he actually announced. And the question was, would he run and what would happen if he ran against a woman? And so I was addressing his race for governor in 1986 when he did do that.
It seems like in many ways he was in quite a different situation then than now.
Better situation now.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things that was interesting to me is that in 1998, you also spoke with him. You interviewed him at length about his philosophy and plans when you were working for a Vermont weekly. And you write that he, at that time, 1998, could already envision a run for president. And he was certain that he would do well.
Oh, yes.
Was he nuts or prescient to think that way back then?
Well, I think prescient, and a lot of us really felt that that it was inevitable. I don't know about winning, but at that point, I think it was more that he could run a very credible third-party campaign. I mean, Bernie didn't talk about it a lot himself, but other people talked about it, starting it when he was in Congress, after about 6 years, and especially when we began to see him showing up at more Democratic functions. We got the feeling that he was really learning the ropes and positioning himself for potentially some sort of run. The question was, what way. And we all, I think a lot of people felt he was a more likely third-party candidate. So the real surprise was that he entered the Democratic primary. For those who were there from the beginning, let's say.
And you did speak with him at one point, and he said he wasn't going to, you know, basically do what Nader had done. Say a little bit more about why he decided to run as a Democrat and what that really means in terms of his relationships with the party.
Well, I mean, that opens up the whole question of the evolution of the relationship. He begins as a third-party anti-war activist at a time when in Vermont, anyway, the Democratic Party really wasn't open to all the countercultural newcomers who were coming to the state. I mean, we were just coming off of 100 years of Republican rule. So it begins that way. And also in Burlington, the biggest city, but a fairly conservative city with a Klanish Democratic Party. And he was a sort of a generational change candidate outside the two-party system. But once he was in power as a mayor, the situation changes. You have to administer, you have to deal with the state legislature, you have to get things done, basically. And so then begins a relationship, a kind of a dance with the Democratic Party from the outside. But there were people who were part of the Progressive Coalition and the larger progressive movement in Vermont who were working inside the party, some working outside. There are allies of Bernie who become officials within the Democratic Party, and gradually he makes peace. He endorsed Jesse Jackson in 88, actually 84 as well, and then once he's in Congress, he forms the Progressive Caucus, which is, of course, populated by all Democrats except for himself, and begins to work in coalition with Democrats. And then finally, during the Clinton scandal, which is when I wrote that article that you mentioned, he appeared in defense of Bill Clinton on the White House lawn. I thought that was quite notable. And so he neutralized the Democratic Party in Vermont, in a sense, by running against it, defeating its candidates, and eventually convincing most of the party leaders that it was better to work with him than to try to fight him.
So that was with the Democratic Party in Vermont. It seems like a lot of the media has been saying that he is, you know, the idea is being put out there that he has no support among the Democratic Party in the House and Senate.
It's a leadership versus base situation nationally. In Vermont as well, the Democratic leadership, the elected officials in Vermont, the governor, the other senator, Patrick Leahy, the mayor of Burlington, other officials have endorsed Clinton, not enthusiastically, but they're on her team. They announced preemptively, you might say, but the base of the Democratic Party is not decided. And across the country, young Democrats or independents-leaning Democrats are in support of him within unions, within movements. But the leadership of those movements have been quick to rally around Hillary Clinton because she has been part of the leadership of the Democratic Party. This is an insurgency. Sanders isn't a Democrat, and a lot of people he's bringing along are, in a sense, occasional Democrats or people who are independents who lean Democratic. So there would be a kind of a difference between how the leadership goes and how their own constituents feel.
What does that bode then for the whole primary nominating process? I mean, you know, my sense has been that Bernie might have a better chance winning in the general than he does winning the nomination. How does that calculus work?
I think you're right about that, actually. In fact, I sometimes feel that he's running a general election campaign right now because he won't pivot. This is the campaign he's running. You know, if Hillary gets the nomination, she's going to immediately pivot back from all of these progressive stands she's been taking to try to show she can, you know, capture the center, because she is essentially a centrist in the end. And Bernie is a leftist, and so he's not going to pivot. His position is what it is. It could split the party. I mean, the question is it's going to be another McGovern situation, or is he really a real set breaker and someone who is more in the realm of Franklin Delano Roosevelt? I just read an article where his sort of background points toward a family heritage where the people were an immigrant family that really worshipped Roosevelt. And in a way, he's talking about the restoration of the New Deal.
Yeah, absolutely, in terms of his positions. And in fact, one of the things I've wondered is why does he paint himself so much as a socialist when in reality he's a New Deal Democrat?
Well, you know, that's a good question. It began when he was elected mayor. He never ran as a socialist. He ran on the Liberty Union Party, which was a kind of countercultural party, but it wasn't an ideological party, really. Socialism was never discussed in those campaigns that I remember. And if anyone asked, you know, that question, they would say, well, we just mean democracy. And that was the end of the discussion. When he was elected mayor, there was a reporter in Burlington. This is a true story. And the reporter for the Burlington Free Press, the Daily, wanted to get his story picked up by the Boston Globe. And, you know, he said an independent was elected in Burlington. They weren't excited, but when he explained that he was a socialist, they put it on the front page, socialist elected in Burlington. And so from that point forward, he had to defend the fact that he was a socialist. At first, he was hesitant to do it, but gradually he recognized that he would always be confronted with this. And so he tried to develop a sort of a definition of his program as the essence of socialism without making it highly ideological. And whenever people ran a campaign against him on the fact that he was a socialist, he would simply ignore it. And in Vermont, it didn't stick. It was never became an issue again, really, after the first couple of years in the 80s.
He seems to be giving socialism a good name. Now, how have you seen him, Bernie Sanders, Greg Gumma, how have you seen Bernie Sanders evolve as a candidate and a politician?
Well, when I met him, he was already a message candidate, but he was so adamant about the message that he didn't have room for, you know, let's say, the human touch. And I think that he has finally recognized how to be a sort of a fuller human being running for this national office. So in that sense, I see him emphasizing more his personality, his, you know, the fact that he relates to people. I mean, I'm impressed with how he connects with people even more. I think he's actually, in some ways, because power agreed with him in a way that was not entirely negative, that in some ways it's made him more humble because he feels he's carrying some sort of responsibility. He's kind of like one of these people who feels with great power comes great responsibility, and he is relatively humble about it compared to a number of other people in politics who I feel are succumbed to a form of narcissism. I would say he's one of the least narcissistic politicians I know.
Now, a lot of people have kind of the idea of him is that he's cantankerous, he doesn't work across party lines,
he can't.
Talk about that.
Well, cantankerous, yes. He'll cut off a press conference if he had the power to, you know, and he didn't like the question. I've seen him shut down press conferences. He won't be able to do that anymore. But on the other side, there's his ability to work across party lines and to get things done. Again, coming from the time as mayor. In Congress, he worked with Republicans on certain pieces of legislation, often having to do with economic issues, international trade, auditing the Fed in the Senate, the vets program with McCain. So he has worked with Republicans. He worked with John Kasich on a bill. He worked with Ron Paul. So, you know, he's capable of, and also he's been an administrator. And so, you know, the downside is that he is kind of let's get it done and a few guys in a room can make a good decision. And perhaps there's a little hubris there. And he has been defeated at times locally because of that. But I think that when he trusts people, he is capable of taking in some new information. I've seen him evolve on environmental issues. He really wasn't very sensitive to them in the 80s. And now I think he sees the dimensions of the problem. And I think on race, he always had a critique. But I think living in such a white state, you kind of lose focus. It is a kind of a different culture. So I think he's had to resensitize himself on that, but I think he's working on it.
Well, you've known him a long time. You've known Bernie Sanders a long time. If you could give him any advice going forward, knowing him as you do, in this presidential campaign, what would you say to him?
Widen his circle of advisors. I think that's key. I think he needs to constantly fight the urge to keep the circle small. Bring in women, more women, and, you know, ask more questions, because the message works, but the world keeps changing.
Well, that's great. Well, Greg Gumma, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Appreciate it.
Greg Gumma is a journalist, novelist, and the author of The People's Republic, Vermont, and the Sanders Revolution. Find links to his articles about the senator at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.